Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram Weekend Edition, Saturday, July 16th, 2022. Section A. Realtors discuss higher interest rates. By Stuart Doreen. Mortgage rates are up, and Midland realtors said they are beginning to feel the impact. But how much? That may depend on which ones you ask. Forbes reported this month that mortgage rates are two percentage points higher than at the start of the year, after registering the biggest quarterly climb in 28 years in the first quarter. Rates for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage have already surged to 5.7%, up from 2.98%. Janine Pruitt is a broker with the Janine Pruitt team. She stated in an email to the Reporter Telegram that the positive impact is represented in the fact that the last few months, 60% of our market has been $200,000 to $400,000, and I do believe this is the price point where people have made the decision to go ahead and purchase a home before the rates increased into the 6.5% or higher range. She believes the negative is hesitancy higher interest rates will create because of economic uncertainty. She wrote, there are price points like $400,000 to $800,000 that typically go under contract in a shorter period of time that appear to be sluggish in the new interest rate environment. Very special properties that truly feel like a staycation and are updated beautifully, like some green tree, are selling quickly. Carol Nall, with the Permian Basin Board of Realtors, wrote that June was a record-setting month for the median price for a home sold in Midland County. That was a 9.5% increase over June of 21. The average price for a home sold was $377,495. The PBBOR also reported that homes sold finished behind the 2021 numbers for the third straight month in June, after being up in January through March. Time will tell how much we really will be impacted by the interest rates. Total units sold is up a little over 6% for the same time frame of last year. Nall added, there are fewer houses on the market at this time than there were last year, and that may have more influence than anything in the buying process. Realtors are advising their buyers to be extra careful about their credit usage in home buying strategies right now. Kerry Payne, owner and broker of the agency, wrote that rising rates are impacting the number of homes going under contract. That number, she wrote, was 411 on March 22nd and on March 24th, and 308 this week. She also noted the available homes on the market has increased to 572. Kerry McNeil with Coldwell Banker wrote, buyers are becoming more selective and asking more in closing costs and repairs. We're seeing listings have longer days on the market, which is consistent with statistics from 30 days in May to 37 days in June. McNeil also noted that the average price per square foot in Midland was around $161 this month, and that those square foot averages increased to around $220 to $240 in new construction areas. Council expects $110 million in savings account, by Stuart Doreen. For the second year in a row, Midland City Council members found out they will end the fiscal year with more than $110 million in their fund balance or general savings account. This brought a discussion about how much is too much to hold on for a rainy day. The answer is not clear-cut. Midland's new director of finance, Christy Weakland, told city leaders this week she's comfortable with having up to 75% or 9 months of general fund spending at hand. The number she said she'd hold like in reserve is around $80 to $90 million. For decades, the city of Midland was consistent in having closer to 35% in reserves, with up to $115 million expected in reserves at the end of fiscal 2020. It was estimated that $52 million would be more in line with what is traditional for the city. City officials said this week the 35% has allowed the city of Midland to enjoy better bond ratings and provided a nice cushion up to this point. Weakland said after talking to other people in government finance positions, having more would help Midland during less stable economic times. What was decided by city leaders is that the city is prepared to spend more than $20 million in one-time capital improvements to get the fund balance down to at least $90 million. Those improvements include $4.5 million for police department projects, including upgrades to the aging headquarters building downtown and a police training facility. City officials also are planning to spend $14.5 million for road improvements. Additional department requests include $1.72 million for community services and $1 million for the fire department. City officials said that sales tax excesses and other increases in revenue have been a reason for the sales tax surge. An increase in 2020 and 2021, when the fund balance increased from $90 to $118 million, was largely due to increased oil and gas revenues and large CARES grant from the government. Between now and when the budget ordinance is adopted in mid-September, city leaders will address the amount they want to see in reserves. Should 35% be the number, then leaders would be looking for another $40 million in projects and one-time expenditures. City leaders said they really don't want to use the savings to help pay for the year's budget, which is more than $110 million more than last year, because those expenses are continual. Still, Scott Dufford, who has served on the second council on the council since 2001, is going to advocate for 35%. He said it is unconscionable to have more than that. We will invest it down. Lori Blong told the reporter Graham she'd like to keep the balance fund a little higher than 35%. She said coming out of a black swan event with the COVID pandemic and negative oil prices, there's a need for the city to be careful. She also said the city leaders should be stockpiling dollars more than necessary or get into a place where the fund balance is overweighted. Crude drops to three-month low amid volatile trading week, by Mel McEwen. Crude prices fell to a three-month low in a volatile week of trading, buffeted by traders increasingly worried about the economic downturn. West Texas Intermediate fell 3 of 5 trading days on the Merc, led by an 8.25 plunge on Tuesday that sent prices below $100 a barrel for the first time since April. Prices remained under the $100 the week for the rest of the week, managing to add $1.81 Friday to close at $97.59 per barrel. The posted price was at $94.07. Natural gas prices on the New York MEX rose 3 of the 5 trading days, jumping to a 39-cent jump on Monday. The price ended the week at 7.016 per MCF. I believe it is the high inflation numbers that has the oil markets concerned, commented Bruce Bullock, director of McGuire Energy Institute at SMU. With both the CPI and PPI posting 40 years high, the market is now convinced of another significant rate hike by the Federal Reserve. That significantly increases the chance of an eventual recession and lower demand for oil. Edward Moyle said, credited an impressive retail sales report for boosting crude prices Friday, saying the sales report illustrated how strong the U.S. economy remains. He added that it appears likely President Biden's trip to the Middle East this week will not lead to an increase in oil supplies. The oil market was down earlier in the week on demand destruction fears, so retail sales report and University of Michigan consumer sentiment data helped undo some of that. Looking ahead, Moya said the big question mark for oil prices is how China's weakening economic data and possibly improving COVID situation will keep their crude demand outlook. Further complicating the outlook for oil, he added, is the revival of Libya's production. Bloomberg reported Friday that Libya, a member of the OPEC, is restarting its oil exports and production from all of its oil fields after reaching a deal with protesters and ending a months-long blockade that had halved its output. Moya said there is always a lot of moving parts for figuring out what will drive oil's next big move, but right now it seems this market is too tight to break below the $90 level. Rising bear activity leads to trail closure. An increase in bear activity has caused the closure of the Window Trail in the Chisos Basin at Big Bend National Park. The park issued an emergency closure due to significantly increased bear activity in the narrow trail corridor. The safety of both the bears and the public is paramount. The trail is closed to public use until further notice. The upper and lower Window Trail heads are closed, and signs have been posted. Entering the closed Window Trail area would be a violation of Chapter 36, according to the press release. National Park biologists are monitoring the bear activity, and we will reopen the trail as soon as the bear activity declines to normal levels. Our goal is to protect both the bears and the park visitors. It's their home. We're the guests. Here's a backstory about the Mexican black bears in the park. The Mexican black bears in Big Bend National Park are one of our success stories. When the park was established in 1944, bear sightings were very rare and infrequent. In the mid-80s, visitors began reporting more and more bear sightings in the Chisos Mountains. Over the years, through migration from Mexico, the bears have reestablished themselves in Big Bend with a stable population without human intervention, which is also a rare event. Don Wayne Mackey passed away on July 11th. The family will receive guests from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday the 17th at Nellie Pickleham Welsh Funeral Home. Services will be at 10 a.m. Monday at Stonegate Fellowship. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Elizabeth Irene Howard passed away on July 14th. A visitation will be held Monday, July 18th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home in Midland. A chapel service will occur Tuesday, July 19th at 10 a.m. at 4616 North Big Spring Street. A burial will occur Tuesday, July 19th at Rest Haven Funeral Home. Eric Christian Unterbrink passed away on July the 11th. Memorial services will be held later in Minnesota. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Linda Lancaster passed away on July 12th. She will be cremated, and a loving memorial celebration will be held later with the surviving family. Samuel Edward Roberts Huber passed away on July 10th. The family has chosen cremation services. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez Thomas Funeral Home. Stephen Randall Tito Boyce passed away on June the 10th in St. Genevieve, Missouri. William Lester Thompson, Jr. of Richardson passed away on June the 8th. He was cremated and will rest in the First United Methodist Church Columbarium in Richardson, Texas. Arturo Atiti passed away on July 7th. Visitation will be Monday, July 18th from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. with a rosary at 7 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Funeral service will be Tuesday, July 19th at 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Luther Adams passed away on July 14th. Graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, July 20th at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickleham Welsh Funeral Home.
Hello, friends. This is Julie reading from the Odessa American, Saturday, July 16th. Canadian oil flow handicapped. Extremely heavy oil flaring problem cited by Bob Campbell. As far away, the United States' number one oil importer, Canada, is big in the American energy industry, even with its problems of low-quality oil and its insufficient means of moving it. That's according to Odessan oilman Kirk Edwards of Clearview Energy Partners, Managing Director Joaquin Rizzo of Washington, D.C. Canadian oil is notoriously dirty, and they have to burn 4 billion cubic feet of natural gas a day to heat those tar sands and make 4 million barrels of oil, Edwards said. Referring to the project, President Biden squelched on his first day in office, Edwards said, another fallacy is the need for the Keystone XL pipeline because they could not give the U.S. one more barrel of oil than what they're doing right now if they had to in the pipeline. All the Keystone XL would do is make it more environmentally safe in transporting that oil across the country. Edwards said Canada has a very robust oil and gas industry, but the government is the key player as opposed to the rights being held by private individuals and companies. The government holds the majority of the rights to drill, and they are dependent on what's being a robust economic system, which may be a reason for them to turn a blind eye to the flaring they have to do to make the oil move. He said most Canada's oil fields are in the western province of Alberta, north of Montana, where some of the world's thickest oil is mixed with a dilute of light hydrogen carbon from natural gas wells to make it transportable by pipelines. Rizzo said Canada's production is a process almost like taking coal out of the ground, boiling it up, because a lot of it starts out as very solid state. They have to turn it into a more usable oil so a refinery can remove the sulfur and other impurities, the research company official said. Rizzo noted that Canada is using the first Keystone pipeline, which was completed in 2010, to Crushing, Oklahoma, and other lines into the U.S., including one in California and a second one called the Trans Mountain Pipeline that's being laid to the West Coast. A lot of their oil goes to the refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast, he said. Most of their main oil fields are pretty far north in the western part of the country, and they have some around Edmonton, north of Calgary. Citing a report from the U.S. Energy Information Agency, Rizzo said Canada is America's top foreign oil supplier, with an average of 3.7 million barrels a day out of the 5 million BPD it produces, compared to the Permian Basin's 5.3 million BPD. That's followed by Mexico with 599,000, Saudi Arabia with 413,000, Colombia with 228,000, Iraq with 223,000, Ecuador with 219,000, United Kingdom with 126,000. Russia was shipping 405 BPD before the invasion of Ukraine. Asked what are American other advantages from its energy relationship with Canada, Rizzo said, the proximity and the political situation, because they are good partners. Their production outpaces the amount of oil they need, and we are their primary customer. What happens is that their prices go down because they have more supply than they have the ability to move. And what the Canadian government calls oil curtailment, they sometimes limit production to get the price raised. Woman convicted in twins' death denied new trial, by Kim Smith. A Midland woman sentenced to 40 years in prison for killing twin girls in an alcohol-related crash 3 years ago was denied a new trial Friday and did not have her sentence reduced either. Angelica Garcia was sentenced June 9th to two consecutive 20-year prison sentences and the July 3rd, 2019 deaths of Mia and Maya Coy. The 34-year-old pled guilty to two counts of intoxication manslaughter on the second day of her trial and left her sentencing up to the jury. The jurors opted to give her two 20-year sentences to Judge Dean Whalen of the Ector County 7th District Court, opted to run the sentences consecutively instead of concurrently. Standing in front of a couple dozen loved ones of the victims, defense attorney Michael McLeish asked Whalen to reconsider Garcia's sentence, saying he was devastated and angry following the sentencing hearing. McLeish noted that in January 2019, Whalen sentenced Mark Garrett, now 28, to 20 years in prison after he pled guilty to three counts of intoxication manslaughter and three counts of intoxication assault. Garrett could have received as much as 90 years in prison. Police arrested Garrett June 22, 2017, after his Dodge Challenger slammed into an ice cream van, which caused both vehicles to burst into flames. The wreck killed three passengers inside the van: Richard Mackerel, 63, his wife, Barbara Mackerel, 46, and Angela Pierce, 28. The wreck seriously injured Garrett, who was drunk, and his three teenage passengers, Maurice Green, Michaela Bazin, and Alexis Dominguez. A man who has sex with a three-year-old is evil. A murderer who intentionally kills is evil, McLeish said. His client is not evil, despite what people are saying on social media, he said. Up until July 3, 2019, Garcia was a happily married woman of two without a criminal record, he said. On that night, she had too much to drink and made a horrible decision to drive. It could have been my wife sitting here, could have been half the jury, it could have been you, it could have been me, it could have been Miss Williams, McLeish said, referring to Assistant District Attorney Melissa Williams. As for his motion for a new trial, MacLeish argued in a written motion that the statute, while unused, was sentencing Garcia is unconstitutional in that it deprives this defendant of her right to trial by jury, including her right to be sentenced by a jury pursuant to her election filed prior to the trial. He reiterated that argument Thursday. Williams told the judge that Garrett and Garcia causes are apples and oranges because Garrett's sentence was stipulated as part of the plea agreement. Garcia had many opportunities to enter a plea agreement, but chose not to, he said. She also argued against the motion for a new trial, noting that statute allows judges to stack sentences as long as they don't exceed a maximum term set by the statute. Whalen told MacLeish that while he understood and appreciated his position, he was denying both motions. MacLeish informed the judge his clients would be pursuing her right to appeal. Summer Learning offers many activities. Youngsters in Ector County ISD's Summer Learning program are getting a sample of music, theater, arts, and STEM, to name a few. A little more than 5,000 students in grades pre-K through 12 attend the programs, which include academics and enrichments. At Milam Elementary Magnet School, Zelia Jenkins said that there are 177 students in grades pre-kindergarten through 5th. They feed in from Blackshear, Reagan, Hayes elementary schools. "It's been doing great," said Jenkins, who is assistant principal at Dowling Elementary. "I think our enrichment has really helped to keep our attendance up. We do have some that drift off, but they look forward to this expression," Jenkins says. "I used to be a counselor, and that's one of the big things in picking your electives. I think an exposure just helps them to narrow down some of the things they might be interested in, or open them up to new things they might be interested in," Jenkins said. She said she schedules the students so that they get a week of everything. Manuela Escojeda, coordinator of the Virtual Academy, is helping with summer learning this year. "It is a full day this year, and there are teachers from the high school that are offering their expertise. Because it is a full day," Jenkins said she thinks more parents sign their children up. They also realize the value in continuing their children's learning. She noted that testing assessments have continued to determine if gaps are closing. "We have a pre-test and a post-test. We're all looking forward to that post-test to see how those gaps have improved. Definitely it's going to be a head start for all those kiddos during the year instead of lots of learning," Jenkins said. Jen Martin, an education consultant with Sperling Center for Research and Innovation, was visiting Tuesday. Executive Director of Instruction and Professional Learning, Lisa Willis, said Martin was here as a part of the additional day school year grant, which is only for elementary. The grant runs for 3 years, and Martin helped with the strategic planning for summer learning, Willis said. OHS Assistant Band Director Jimmy Oblige was teaching elementary students about drumming on tabanos and learning rhythm by drumming out what they had for dinner and performing small solos. He said he taught students young children one before, but not in the group. "It was a learning experience for me, trying to create and figure out how to reach them and teach them and how to keep them on task with what they're doing in class. They're so energetic. Their minds are all over the place. They want to do something different every 30 seconds to a minute and then go down to something else. I figured out what to do to keep them in line. It's been cool. It's been really neat. A great learning experience for me. I've really enjoyed it," Oblige said. He added that the students get instant gratification from the drums. "They just hit the drum and they do something. We use a lot of questions about what they had for dinner or rhymes. They're learning math without talking about it. How one's note is longer than the other or faster than another. I'm not writing musical notes on the board. We're just answering questions by hand drumming." At Cameron Elementary, Maya Coy, 11-year-old who goes to Cameron, says she enjoyed the activities of summer school. This is her first year. Coy said she would do it again. This is also a chance to see her peers during the summer. Good morning, friends. This is Julie, reading from the Odessa American, Sunday, July 17th. Milam Principal Excited About Chance to Lead, by Ruth Campbell. From a young age, Dorothy Ortiz wanted to coach, teach, and lead. Now Ortiz finds herself a campus chief at Milam Magnet Elementary. Ortiz, her husband Dusty, and two children, Mabry 8 and Luke 11, moved to Odessa for Dusty's new position as Odessa High School football coach. Last year, Ortiz's first year with Ector County ISD, she was assistant principal at Burnett Elementary. I did a lot of principal duties off and on last year, said Burnett. She added, previously, Ortiz was at Keller ISD, just north of Fort Worth. I really have enjoyed everything I've learned from the different entities that we used at Burnett last year, like Opportunity Culture and Big Rocks, Ortiz said. Keller ISD has a very high-performing school, she said. I had a lot of fun working at a Title I school and learning some new things about what it takes to help students close the gaps and have high success. Really, it's very similar to what you do at high-performing schools. You just need to make sure that those things are being implemented, that those practices are in place for your staff and for your students, Ortiz said. She's taking over for Natalie Fitzgerald, who is now Director of Human Resources for ECISD. Ms. Fitzgerald has really helped me with the transition. She's really helped make this transition so smooth. She had a lot of great things already in place here at Milam, Ortiz said. Fitzgerald said that during the short time she has spent working with Ortiz while transitioning to her new role in HR, I came to believe she will be a great leader for Milam Fine Arts Academy. Ortiz added that Milam offers many great opportunities for students in fine arts. My goal as a principal here is to take Milam's greatness and work with the team of staff that we have here, keep rising, just continuing to make Milam an exceptional place for students to learn and grow, Ortiz said. The campus has just over 600 students and a total staff of 60, including more than 30 teachers. I think some of the things that I'll be bringing into the staff this year will really simplify things and make things that we're doing very efficient and allow teachers to have planning time that they need to really prepare and make what they're doing in their classrooms exceptional, Ortiz said. Ortiz grew up in Groon, and she says she has so many opportunities there, being close to Austin and San Antonio. I had great teachers, great coaches in my life who really influenced me to hop on this path, she said. She earned a bachelor's degree in kinesiology with a minor in criminal justice and physical science. She and her husband took master's degrees in education leadership from Lamar University. Ortiz played college soccer and was a standout. I'm actually in the Hall of Honor, which is basically the Athletes Hall of Fame at Angelo State, Ortiz said. She played forward on the soccer team, but if her coach needed her elsewhere, she would do it. But I did play forward, and I still hold some of the records there for goals and points that are over 20. Years old, Ortiz said. She added that she's glad she chose Angelo State because she was able to go on an academic and athletic scholarship, and I was in the military as well. I was in the Marine Corps Reserves during my time at Angelo State, too. I actually went to Officer Candidate School, and I was an honor graduate for leadership. That was in the first 6 weeks course. After the course, I went back to Angelo State to continue playing soccer and going to school, and I met my husband, Ortiz said. He wanted to become a coach and teacher, and I had always had the aspiration of being a coach and teacher as well. So when we met, we both just got on the path for education and started our journey coaching and teaching, she said. Ortiz was active for 6 months during Operation Enduring Freedom. I'm a veteran, too. So when we got out to start coaching and teaching when he graduated, right as the transition was happening, I got activated for Operation Enduring Freedom. So it kind of changed my path as far as becoming an officer in the military as well, she said. Because of an officer training school, I hadn't been to Marine combat training so immediately. I got sent to combat training in North Carolina. Then they returned me back to my unit. We had plans to go overseas to Afghanistan with my unit, but they decided to keep me as a reserve working with the families. I worked with the families during that time and took care of all the documentation that needed to be taken care of to make sure that the Marines were getting paid and their medical documents were often taken care of. So I just kind of stayed back in the reserve unit in Lubbock, Texas, Ortiz said. Coming off activation, she started coaching and teaching in Hereford. Dusty Ortiz started his career, Hart, where he grew up. Her military background also helps her stay calm in types of situation, helps her appreciate and celebrate the little things. Currently, Ortiz is having a one-on-one meeting to really get to know my staff and make sure we're fully prepared for this school year together, and I've had a great time building these relationships. I'm also looking forward to finding some ways to improve our parents and community at Milam, she said. Chief of Schools Kelsey Boyer said Ortiz is a very hard worker, committed to engaging learning experience for all her students. She has a variety of leadership experiences, including time as both an elementary and secondary assistant principal, Boyer said. Still wary. Some Texans comply with requests to conserve power. Bennett Shanae Day, Mitchell Furman, Jaden Edison, and Jamie Lozano, the Texas Tribune. In the sweltering heat, Everett Gray, on Wednesday, wearily turns up the thermostat to help lessen the stress on the state's electricity system. Gray set the temperature to 80 degrees at their aunt's Denton home, where they have been pet-sitting for their family's 60-pound poodle. They also unplugged most household appliances and closed the blinds. "I've got this horrible mindset that I can fix the grid, so just took a shower in the dark," Gray said. Twice this week, the state's main power grid operator had asked Texans to cut back on their emergency use, and back in May, ERCOT asked Texans to conserve power during a heat wave that coincided with the 6 power plant outages. Asking people to reduce electricity usage is the first step ERCOT takes when the stability of Texas' power grid is threatened. The grid must keep supply and demand in balance at all times, and when it fails below its safety margin of excess supply, the grid operator takes additional precautions to avoid blackouts. The all-time record for demand has already been broken several times this summer. A spokesman for the Electric Reliability Council of Texas said some Texans respond to this week's request. Demand on the grid was reduced on Monday by 500 megawatts during the time the first conservation request. On Wednesday, demand was reduced by at least 100 megawatts. In the end, the grid remained stable and ERCOT did not have to implement any serious emergency measures this week. But tight grid conditions have become a source of anxiety, confusion, and trauma, and conservation requests are reminded that the state still struggles to keep up with the growing demand for power. Residents like Gray have responded to ERCOT's pleas, while other Texans say the grid stability is the responsibility of the state leaders. Gray, a student at University of North Texas, is going to extremes to help conserve power because they're terrified of experiencing blackouts after the February 21 winter storm, when millions of Texas residents were without power for days in sub-freezing temperatures, a combination of cold weather across the state and skyrocketing demands for energy shut down power plants, as well as natural gas facilities and supply them with fuel. Hundreds of people died. This week, some Texans who need power the most also wanted to help. Inside a North Houston community center that served as designated cooling facility for people to avoid the heat on Wednesday, Walitha Miller parked her walker, sat on a bench, sipped a Sprite, and she waited for her ride home. Next on her was Blue, beat the heat sign, responded by energy giant Reliant. "I need AC because I have lung problems," she said. Miller, 58, was at the cooling facility only briefly. She said she would attempt to do her part to conserve energy when she went home. "When I get home, I might turn on the fan and see if I can deal with it for a while," she said. Wednesday's call for conservation came after a combination of higher-than-expected outages as coal and natural gas-fired power plants, as well as low wind and soaring temperatures. Solar power, which has performed well this summer, also struggled Wednesday to produce as much electricity as expected, ERCOT said, because of some dark clouds over solar farms in West Texas. Texas is facing extreme heat conditions this year, which must see the state enduring temperatures above 100 degrees. Climate change has made Texas heat both hotter and longer lasting. The average daily minimum and maximum temperatures in Texas have both increased by 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 125 years. The state just saw its hottest December of record since 1889. Miller said she has trouble breathing when it's hot out, but she understands the grid operators need help from Texans to protect the state's power network. "But there's got to be something for people that have health issues," Miller said. "Everyone can't get up and go to a cooling center. I'm on a walker. I can't go to no cooling center all the time." ERCOT's appeal to conserve energy was voluntary, which means some Texans could choose not to respond. Nicole Nagy, 40, said she already practiced energy conservation in her everyday life and was going to ride all the roller coasters that is unpredictability of the grid stability in ERCOT's calls for conservation. The legal assistant spent Wednesday afternoon in the shade of a large tree at Austin's Barton Spring Pool with one of her 5 children. Pflugerville resident Chris Lee did not change his energy habits on Wednesday either. The 38-year-old jeweler said he generally tries to conserve energy to keep his electricity bill low, turning up the thermostat to 76 degrees before he leaves the house, But he said the government shouldn't have to ask Texans to take on the responsibility protecting the power grid. People should be able to have the thermostat at whatever they want it, Lee said, while eating a meal from Chick-fil-A in the air-conditioned Barton Creek Square Mall. The government needs to come up with innovative ways to help the power grid up or get electricity from somewhere else. For residents in a swamp of southwest Texas, ERCOT's conservation calls aren't a concern. They're a part of a different power grid, the Eastern Interconnection, the power grid that covers the eastern part of the United States. Seated on the patio of Mahoney's Texas Bar and Restaurant in the Woodlands, Mike Hendricks, who was off from work on Wednesday and went shopping for his Husky Reaper, said he wasn't told to conserve electricity. Haven't heard anything about that today, Hendricks said of the conservation appeal. Hendricks said he keeps the thermostat at home at 69 degrees. In Lubbock, on the other side of the state, Angela Flores says she takes conservation alerts seriously because she doesn't want to face power outages. Lubbock wasn't always part of ERCOT grid. The region joined ERCOT last May, 3 months after the winter storm. At the time, Lubbock officials said the plans to join ERCOT had been years in the making and were too far ahead to change. Flores says she moved to Lubbock before the winter storm. When she was reading about the problem with ERCOT during the disaster, she said she felt like she had moved just in time to avoid them. Now that Lubbock is part of ERCOT grid, she cautions, "We keep the thermostat at 75 during the day, which isn't great, but it's better than the alternative," Flores says. "I couldn't imagine if we lost power. I'd be worried about my son. It's just too hot to be without power." The article originally appeared in the Texas Tribune in tinyurl.com/YZZ2YKNY. The Texas Tribune is a member-supported, nonpartisan news group informing and engaging Texas on state politics and policy. Two kids among six dead in Montana highway pileup, the Associated Press. Two children are among the six people who died in Montana pileup after a Friday evening dust storm caused blackout conditions on Interstate 90, a major route in both Montana and the western U.S. Montana Highway Patrol Sergeant Jay Nelson said investigators so far found no other factors that contributed to the pileup that also sent eight other injured people to hospitals. "Everything is indicative of an isolated extreme weather event," Nelson said of the investigation, calling the crash among the worst he'd seen in 24 years with the state. "What could people do? It really was just panic. The pileup was just west of Hardin, and additional ambulances called in from Billings to help. The identities of the dead and conditions of the survivors are not yet being released. The crash was reported around 4:30 p.m. as 21 vehicles, including six commercial semi-trucks, lost control in the dust storm that was fueled by gusts topping 60 miles per hour, authorities said. Nelson said there was zero visibility for a mile-long stretch during a peak summer traffic hour for those commuting home from work or traveling for outdoor recreation. "It took more than 6 hours to fully reopen the road. We had a lot of debris and complete chaos," Nelson said. Governor Greg Gifante said on Twitter, "I'm deeply saddened by the news of a mass casualty crash near Hardin. Please join me in prayer to lift up the victims and their loved ones. We're grateful to our first responders for their service." Montana Attorney General Austin Cudson, who oversees the Highway Patrol, said in a statement that the Montana Highway Patrol, which he oversees, was investigating. He will release more information as it becomes available and is appropriate out of respect for the lives lost and their loved ones. A video from the Billings Gazette showed hundreds of tractor-trailers, campers, and cars backed up for miles along the two eastbound lanes of the interstate. Before the pileup, storms popped up in south-central Montana between 1 and 2 p.m. and slowly began moving east, said Nick Vertes, a National Weather Service meteorologist in Billings. "Those storms prompted a severe thunderstorm, which covered Hardin and other parts of Montana from mid-afternoon until 9 p.m. Friday. Meteorologists forecasted the potential of isolated hail the size of a quarter, scattered gusts up to 75 miles an hour, and frequent lightning. So-called outflow, or a surge of wind that potentially produced by the storm, flew about 30 miles ahead of the storm," Vertes said. "Winds picked up quickly and around the time of the crash, according to the reading at nearby Big Horn County Airport, a 40-mile-per-hour gust was reported about 15 minutes before the crash was reported. In less than an hour, another burst of wind hit 64 miles per hour. The wind easily picked up dust, a product of recent temperatures into the 90s and triple digits over the last week, and reduced visibility to less than a quarter mile. Obituaries. Elizabeth Irene Howard, Midland. Elizabeth Irene Howard, age 101, of Midland, Texas, was born on February 21, 1921, in Duncan, Oklahoma, to Frank and Pearl Bond. She passed away peacefully on July 14th and woke up to streets of gold with her heavenly father and loved ones who went before her. Snooky was a nickname she earned as a young child and would be most of her friends would refer to her to this day. Her father, Frank, was an oil man, which eventually sent this family to Tyler, Texas, where she grew up and graduated high school. She met the love of her life, Raymond Howard, while in high school. The couple married August 3, 1940. They would later move to Midland, Texas in 1947, where Raymond was employed with Atlantic Oil Company. Snooky and Raymond welcomed their first one child and daughter, Beth, on July 27, 1953. Snooky moved into the independent living apartments at Manor Park in 2009. She enjoyed welcoming potential and new residents to the community and was featured in several commercials, newspaper ads, while living at Manor Park. Snooky loved playing bingo, going to happy hour, trips to eat with friends, and attending the Vesper service in the campus chapel. She moved into nursing care on October 2021, where the staff cooks took such excellent care of Miss Snooky. The family would like to thank those at Manor Park for wonderful love and care they gave her in the last few months of her life. Snooky is preceded in death by her parents, Frank and Pearl Bond, sister Colleen Johnson, brother Lieutenant Colonel Julius Henry Bond, husband Raymond Howard, and son-in-law Sherman Carroll. She is survived by her daughter, Beth Carroll, and longtime boyfriend John Carroll of Odessa. The family asked that in lieu of flowers that donations be made to First Presbyterian Church of Midland, Meals on Wheels, Manor Park, Sibley Nature Center, or a charity of your choice. Fond memories and expressions of sympathy may be shared at www.ellisfuneral.com for the Howard family. The visitation for Elizabeth will be held Monday, July 18th from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home, 4616 North Big Spring Street, Midland, Texas, 79705. A chapel service will occur Tuesday, July 19th at 10 a.m., 4616 North Big Spring Street, Midland, Texas. A burial will occur Tuesday, July 19th at 11 a.m., 4616 North Big Spring Street, Midland, Texas. Death notices. Andrea C. Cardoza, Odessa. Andrea C. Cardoza, 76, of Odessa, died Tuesday, July 12th in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 10 a.m., July 19th, First United Pentecostal Church. Pastor Terry Pugh is officiating. Arrangements are by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Carolina Silvas Carol Chavez, Odessa. Carolina Silvas Carol Chavez, 75, of Odessa, died Wednesday, July 13th in Odessa. Celebration of life is scheduled for 10 a.m. Wednesday, July 20th. At Martinez Funeral Home Chapel. Burial to be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, July 21st. Holy Angels Cemetery in Alpine, Texas. Pastor Craig DeArmond and Bob Miller are officiating. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. David Kuhn, Odessa. David Kuhn, 58, of Odessa, died Wednesday, July 13th in Odessa. Memorial service is scheduled for 10:30 a.m. July 22nd at Union Church of Grand Falls. Arrangements are by Harkley Funeral Home of Grand Falls. Dolores LaRue Spruce Lewis, Odessa. Dolores LaRue Spruce Lewis, 75, of Odessa, died Tuesday, July 12th in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 1 p.m. on Monday, July 18th at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home. Visitation will be held prior to services from 10 a.m. to 1 on Monday. Arrangements are by Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home of Odessa. Enrique Munoz Valenzuela Sr., Odessa. Enrique Munoz Valenzuela Sr., 76, of Odessa, died Wednesday, July 13th in Odessa. Mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Tuesday, July 19th at St. Joseph Catholic Church. Burial to follow at Ector County Cemetery in Odessa, Section 2. Father Carlos Rodriguez is officiating. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, July 18th. Brawl after Warbirds game prompts investigation. Players, coaches, fans involved in West Texas's victory. The Ector County Sheriff's Office is busy collecting video footage and statements from people who attended Saturday's West Texas Warbirds game after a melee broke out following their 50-6 drubbing of the Dallas Prime. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said the half a dozen of his deputies who were providing security Saturday night had to ask for help from on-duty deputies and the Odessa Police Department after multiple fights broke out between, quote, more than a dozen, many, several people. Griffiths confirmed players even went into the stands and attacked fans during the Warbirds' final game of the season. Quote, to my knowledge, no one sought medical treatment or went to the hospital, Griffiths said. Law enforcement officers identified every participant and every injured party and will be reaching out to them to obtain statements, Griffiths said. If the injured want to pursue charges and sign affidavits, arrest will follow. Quote, no arrests were made last night. Our main goal was to get everyone broken up and dispersed, Griffiths said. The investigation will likely take some time, the sheriff said. We're going to be collecting all of the videos, Griffiths said. I imagine it will be a somewhat lengthy process to get everything substantiated and corroborated, end quote. By videos, Griffiths said he was referring to both body cam footage and people's cell phone videos, many of which are appearing on social media. Right now, it's unclear who started the brawls, but it was, quote, quite a deal, he said. Quote, the Dallas team got their butts spanked and tempers flared, Griffiths said. Warbirds head coach Tate Smith added that the altercation continued after a player from each team was ejected at the end of the contest. Warbirds and Dallas coaches tried to break things up and get the teams in their respective locker rooms, but the situation quickly escalated. Quote, we were told by the officials that if there were any problems on the field, that players would be ejected, Smith said. That's what happened, and it carried over after the game was finished. That team, Dallas, hadn't lost in more than 2 years, and we handled them pretty good, end quote. The team has scheduled a press conference for 1 p.m. today at the Ector County Coliseum to speak about Saturday's game and the future of the franchise. Six off-duty deputies are normally assigned to the game, but moving forward, Griffiths said they will be working with the Coliseum director to get protocols established for more security during the breaks and at the end of the games. What happened Saturday night was a shame, he said. Quote, everyone needs to exhibit good sportsmanship, Griffiths said. Take time to pick a nursing home. The story was written by Carol A. Cates, Chief Nursing Officer, Odessa Regional Medical Center. So many of my friends and I are at that time of our lives where we are in the sandwich generation, that time in life when you are finishing raising your kids and starting to raise your parents. This has really come home to me lately because of my dad. He is in his early 80s, and thank goodness he is still in really good health. But in the last 2 years, he has lost his wife, my stepmom, 4 siblings, and another 4 siblings-in-law. Most of those people spent at least some time in long-term care, assisted living, or a nursing home during the last few weeks to years. For my family, the choice of long-term care has been pretty simple, the church my dad was raised in and that most of my family still attend in Churchill, Montana, has run a retirement village and nursing home since the 1950s. That retirement village has cared for generations of my family and given excellent care for years and years. But if my dad ever needs that kind of care, Churchill is a long, long way from me or any of my siblings since we all live in Texas. Because of that, I have started thinking quite a bit about what I am going to do if my dad does need assistance at some point and started doing some research on how to go about this process. Experts in the field of care for the elderly make several recommendations as you are considering long-term or nursing home care for a loved one. First, make sure the location is convenient for their primary decision maker and, if possible, other loved ones to visit regularly. One of the things I know from seeing patients in the hospital setting and from my own family and friends is that when people in long-term care are regularly visited and our primary decision maker can monitor their care, the quality of care the person in long-term care or nursing home care receives tends to be better. I honestly don't think it's purposeful. I just think a family member who has known someone for years notices changes quicker than someone who may have only known that person for a few days or even a few weeks, and because of that, intervention is started sooner. Second, do your research. There is a huge amount of information out there about healthcare facilities of all types these days, which is great, but not all of it is accurate. Make sure you are looking at reliable sources for your information. There are businesses out there that will steer you toward nursing homes that they have marketing and financial arrangements with, so they are not unbiased. Unfortunately, there is a huge amount of fraud directed at the elderly as well, so you need to keep that in mind as you are doing your research. One of the best places I know of for researching any healthcare facility is Medicare.gov and their Find and Compare tool. You plug in your zip code, the provider type you are looking for, in this case, nursing home, and it will give you all the facilities of that type within a 25-mile radius. You can change that radius if you want. For every facility, it gives a 1 to 5 star rating, 1 is worst, 5 is best. Medicare star ratings are based on several metrics from how they perform on health inspections to the resident-to-staff ratios and their overall quality of care based on prevention of events like falls, bed sores, and infection outbreaks. You can look at an overall score or the breakdown on each metric they use. You can also go to the Nursing Facility Quality Review page on the Texas Health and Human Services website at tinyurl.com/2S4JWVYV and find the actual report from the facility's last health and safety survey by the state. Finally, take a tour of the facility you are considering and ask questions. Nursing leadership and administration should be able to tell you things like how they are protecting residents from infection outbreaks like COVID-19, what they do to prevent falls or other injuries, if they have visitor policies or restrictions, what the staffing ratios are like. The more staff, especially licensed nurses per patient, the better. And what their staffing turnover is like. Remember, the longer someone knows your loved one, the more likely they are to pick up on problems early, so lower turnover is better. Ask how they prepare for disasters like fires and tornadoes. Ask how they make sure people are getting adequate fluid and nutrition and how they accommodate special diets. Ask if residents are restricted to dining hours or if they can eat when they want. Talk to current residents if you can and ask if they are happy with the care they receive and with living there. Ask them if the caregivers are kind and if they have freedom of choice. If they do not allow you to speak to current residents, ask why. If you get answers you are concerned about, ask for more details until you get answers you like, or consider looking at another facility. No place is perfect, unfortunately, but there is a wide variety of options. The most important thing is to find a place that best fits your loved one's needs and your needs and will give your loved ones the best possible care. Here are some Odessa American quick hits. Young Adults Events. The Ector County Library, 321 West 5th Street, has organized Origami, Book Exchange, and Cleaner and Greener today through Saturday in the Young Adult Department. Call 432-332-0633 or visit ector.lib.tx.us. Free STD testing. The Ector County Health Department, 221 North Texas Avenue, has scheduled free STD testing from 8:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. and from 1:30 p.m. to 4 p.m. today through Wednesday. Results are never given to anyone other than the person being tested. Call 432-498-4141, extension 0, or visit tinyurl.com/YCYJPEPC. After school care. This fall, Campfire West Texas will be offering a state-licensed school care for students on 10 Odessa campuses, Austin, Burnett, Gonzales, Pease, Bice, Cameron, Ross, Burleson, and Jordan Elementary School. Your child must attend the school offering the kids' care program to be eligible. Registration will begin at 9 a.m. today and will continue until all spots are filled. The after-school programs are operated by Campfire West Texas, and components of the program include homework help, games, arts and crafts, outdoor recreation, and traditional campfire activities and projects. The program will be offered from the time school is out until 6 p.m. Enrollment will be limited, with a child-to-adult ratio of not more than 15:1, to provide attention and quality supervision. To register for kids' care, you must complete an online registration form and pay a $20 annual fee for each child enrolled. A weekly $50 fee will be charged per child, and financial assistance is available for those who qualify. Online registration forms are only available at campfirewtx.org or call 432-570-4144. The Ector County Library, 321 West 5th Street, has scheduled Family Coloring Night from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. today in the Basement Activity Room. Call 432-332-0633 or visit ector.lib.tx.us.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.